This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Scholarly Communication, the podcast about how knowledge gets known. I'm Avi Stammen, co-host of the Scholarly Communication podcast. When I'm not podcasting, I dedicate my time to my family, biking out in the mountains, and running my company, Academic Language Experts. Academic Language Experts, or ALE for short, is an author services company dedicated to helping scholars elevate their manuscripts prior to publication, and grant proposals to receive research funding. I'm also working on a new startup called SciWriter AI, which is going to be the first artificial intelligence co-pilot tool for academic writing. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by Nico Fund, president at Oxford University Press USA office. Nico is the academic publisher of Oxford University Press and president of Oxford's US office. He began his career at Oxford back in 1987. I will reveal that that was the year of my birth. As an editorial assistant in law and social science before moving to NYU Press in 1990, where he was an editor and then editor-in-chief before becoming director in 1996. He returned to Oxford in 2000, where he is responsible for oversight of the press's research and reference publishing arm. A past president of the Association of University Presses, he serves or has served on various boards, including those of the Digital Public Library of America, Eurasia Group Foundation, the Executive Council of the Professional and Scholarly Publishing Division of the American Publishers, and the literary magazine The Common. Nico, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Brilliant. So let's get started here. And you have quite the extensive experience when it comes to academic publishing, but I want to kind of take you back down memory lane for a minute here and ask you if you can remember that first time, the sweet young love, when you actually realized, wow, this is something I enjoy doing and maybe, you know, could do this for a career.
Yeah, it was unsurprisingly related to a book. It was one of the first books I worked on, which was called Freedom Summer by a sociologist named Doug McAdam. And he was writing about people who had participated in the Mississippi Freedom Summer voter registration drive in 1964, 1965. And he was trying to address this myth that was very much in the culture at the time, that all the 60s radicals had basically become, were running nightclubs and gone into finance and had essentially betrayed their younger ideals. So he went around and interviewed a lot of the veterans of Freedom Summer and found that almost all of them were still very much active in causes of social justice, many of them having led lives of privation in order to fulfill their what they saw as their purpose. And I thought the testimonies in that book were really striking, and it converged at a time that we were publishing the Schoenberg series of 19th century Black women writers, which was a series that Henry Louis Gates had pitched to the press. And we reissued essentially an entire corpus of literature in the form of these 20 books that were written by Black women, many of them having to have white scholars attesting in a foreword to the fact that these women had in fact written these books at the time. And so we reissued those, and I had the good fortune of being at Towson State University when we exhibited them for the first time. And I was really struck by the adulation and reverence with which the debut of that series was greeted. And it just struck me that this was a really nice convergence of a form of benevolent commerce, of a purposeful commerce, and the kind of academic adjacent work that I hoped to pursue without necessarily being in the academy per se. So yeah, and that feeling has not only never faltered, but I would say that given the age we're currently in, and you know, this intersects somewhat with the subject we're going to talk about, I think the role of these presses that are here to try to disseminate proven, tested, vetted content is as important as ever before.
Yeah, so that is going to be the topic of our discussion today, is the value of content in an age of artificial intelligence and the age of LLMs. I guess a kind of cynical approach would say, well, with the ability to create endless content, you know, almost at the click of a button, a lot of garbage in, garbage out, and kind of what's the value of that. And I think that what's interesting to me, full disclosure, I just recently published an article in Scholarly Kitchen that Nico was really helpful. You were very helpful in helping me kind of form my thoughts about it. But what's really kind of been on my mind recently is, well, if we're going to build out these large language models, right? And if generative AI is here to stay, well, then, you know, it's kind of this black box of what's the source of all these materials, right? And I think we've gotten bits and pieces here and there about ChatGPT that, you know, it's a mix of some of the scholarly record, but you've also got, you know, some Quora answers, maybe some Reddit threads, and you've got a lot. It's a big salad and a big mix of different things. And I think that's part of the problematics that come out of that. And, you know, the question that I've been asking out loud and to others and to anyone who wants to listen is, well, what is, what's the potential and what's the possibility for a large language model or for generative AI that's actually based on the scientific corpus and scientific record? But so I want to kind of, that's just to set the stage. But in order to kind of delve into that topic, I want to just start off by asking you kind of to go over for maybe those who are less familiar, a bit of a, you know, under the hood or behind the scenes of what exactly is a large language model and how do they work? And then we can kind of take it from there.
Yeah, I mean, you've touched on one aspect of this subject that I think is, if not unprecedented, certainly one of the more extreme features of the way in which this has come onto the landscape as quickly as it has, which is that I'm hard pressed to think of something that is both so intriguing, so complicated, and so exhausting to try to keep track of. I mean, you mentioned the piece you wrote, Avi. I was just thinking back to the people whom I've drawn on to try to educate myself about this, whether it's Joe Esposito, your fellow chef at Scholarly Kitchen, or my colleagues, Casper Grathwall, Aaron O'Reilly, Sophie Jackson Wood, all these people. And I realize I've been engaged in this massive hoovering up of every perspective I possibly can to try to get my brain around this subject. So as far as I can, you know, understand it, to reduce this to the most basic, and this goes into the anxiety some people have about, you know, using the term artificial intelligence. A lot of the people who work in the lexical part of Oxford are at pains to highlight to me that is a deceptive term. Large language models is really what we should be relying on, since essentially these are word prediction engines that are looking at the preceding words and based upon those words are drawing conclusions about what the most likely next word is going to be. And because we are very susceptible to perceive intelligence where there is not intelligence, we attribute an intelligence there that is merely a very complicated algorithm. So, but even that is changing because, of course, these are founded on our neural networks, and they learn with shocking rapidity. And that's why there's, I think, such alarm in so many different quarters around not just how quickly this is all happening before any form of legislation can catch up to it, but also for those of us who recollect the questioning of Mark Zuckerberg on Capitol Hill, the fact that, you know, our political class is not necessarily any better equipped to grapple with these issues than I think a lot of the people who are talking heads about them.
Yeah, I've been trying to coin the term, I don't know, maybe unsuccessfully, but in trying to conceptualize what these LLMs are as Wordle on steroids. That's kind of the way that I like to think about them, is it's like, you know, imagine if you have the power to kind of predict what the most likely combination of words is, you know, you'd always be solving Wordle in one or two tries. And obviously that's kind of a little bit in jest and comical, but I do think it is important to give context, is that the word that I think is most often forgotten is actually language, right? So when I think a lot of the mistakes that kind of come from these large language models or from people's use of them, maybe is a more exact way of saying it, is trying to understand them as information models or trying to understand them as alternatives, either for search, Google search, or for even for Wikipedia. And I think that actually we need to go back to the word language, which is exactly what you said. It's, you know, understanding the power in the linguistic sense less and maybe an informational sense. But I'm curious kind of in your role and in your seat as, you know, at Oxford, what are some of the major issues that your, you know, publishers or, you know, your staff are coming to you with about LLMs, and what are some of the biggest issues that you've seen thus far?
Yeah, well, I think, I mean, again, this is such a fast moving target. But I think one of the things that one has to ask oneself at the very start is this technology sufficiently mature, ready enough for us to want to participate in it? Is it something that we think, with all the hallucinations that occur? And I think that's the tendency of ChatGPT and others to make stuff up, I think is really indicative as to why this came onto the market as quickly as it did. I think that for most people in our world, you wouldn't put something out there that was as consistently wrong about basic factual matters as it is. So it highlights to me, at least, the fact that this was driven by commercial and capitalist motivations, a race to market, and that people wanted to be the first out there, even though it's not quite ready for prime time. So that's, I think, a worry in its own right. I think the fact that so much of the content these days is now generated, that is on the internet, is generated automatically, means that, and I think there's conflicting research about this already, whether or not these LLMs are getting more or less accurate. Because the idea is, if you're simply churning through masses of automatically generated information, then you're not necessarily going to get any better. It's you're basically having LLMs draw on LLM generated content or automatically generated content. And I think that goes to one of the heart of the issue for me, which is that I, like everybody else, have been dazzled by the quality of the answers to questions, the work that LLMs can do. But what has not, when people talk about how it's boring, how the prose is dull, I think all of us, consume information, read or do research, because we're looking for that thing that it does to our brain that is, that we can feel, that is counterintuitive, or it teaches us something, or we get an insight. There's something that happens in your mind when you're exposed to something that you haven't thought about before, or that explains something to you haven't had before. And that, I think, I have not seen that as yet at all. And I may just not be asking the right questions or going to the right places. But I think that, and again, that's not a retentive point. That's not a defending the old guard. That's not, saying human creativity will always out, because that's not necessarily true. But I think for the time being, it is a tool that is very useful for a lot of very interesting tasks, but complicated tasks even. But I have not yet seen anything that rises to that level of insight.
Do you think, as a kind of theoretical exercise, not knowing what the results would be, do you think that it is worth our time, either as academics or scholarly publishing, to try and see what an LLM would look like based on a scholarly record? Do you think that could hold inherent value, and if so, kind of what potential benefits could you see that having?
Yeah, I mean, very much so. So I think that the move now from LLM to SLM, this idea that you want to be drawing on small language models that are tested and proven, I think that's very promising, and I very much agree with that. I think that if you ask a question of a different data set, one from the other, you're going to get a very different set of answers. And if you ask, as we all know, the internet writ large a question, you're going to get a very different answer than if you ask a vetted database. But I think that there's the theoretical questions that we're dealing with, and then there are the very real, pragmatic, practical questions that publishers already have to deal with. Are we willing to publish AI-generated content? I suspect right now already there are any number of academics using various tools to improve their manuscripts, to fine-tune translations, to maybe do the initial draft of a translation, and then fine-tune it based, on that draft. But there are the question of what does that look like contractually? What does that look like in terms of the work that we do? ChatGPT, I think, allows its users to make use of its content in pretty much any way it wants to, but it does request that you that you actually specify that a content is AI generated. So I think, and I think also ChatGPT, if I'm not mistaken, enables you to restrict your data sets, right? Like that's something that I think is not as widely known as it should be, that you can refine the answers, the source of the answers you're being provided. And I think that whether, to your question, we end up with large menu and you can widen or shrink the data that is being drawn from, or you just have different sites for different purposes. In the same way right now, you know, Wikipedia serves a very different purpose than, let's say, the OED. If I want to learn about the origin of a word, the etymological origin of a word, I go to the OED. If I want to learn about the origin of a band, I go to Wikipedia. So I think that, that is still very much up in the air, I think.
Yeah, these are, you know, it is interesting to think about from kind of the researcher perspective. I know that, you know, when I think about these issues, because I've spent the last 10 years kind of helping researchers from English is not their native language publish, I know they're up against, like, really, it's an uphill battle each and every time to try to get their research published, regardless of, you know, the quality of the research they're doing or, you know, the level of that they're working at. And so my, you know, kind of knee-jerk reaction is like, oh, this is a great way that they can really be empowered to help them. But we've done a real deep dive into this, and we find that it's an interesting, it's sort of an interesting two sides of the same coin, where one side is, it really, like you said before, has potential, especially with language, to do really great work and to really refine in a way which I do think there's sparks of human creativity. I'm not talking about, you know, kind of, you know, the full, you know, kind of critical thinking from scratch, but, you know, in terms of at least rephrasing in a way which can be more understandable. And that's really powerful. On the other hand, at the same time, I mean, we've been playing around with this internally with our staff. So they'll come back to me and say, today was great. The next day it was awful. Then I had a paragraph that was entirely missing. Recently, someone told me that there was an entirely new paragraph with content that wasn't, like, at all related to the original text that was thrown in. So I think it's maybe the lack of predictability and consistency, and what's really critical for researchers to know is, with, I don't know, sounds cliche, but with great power comes a big responsibility to check what work, you know, what's actually being done. So in a certain ironic way, it can do better work, but it actually needs to be checked a lot more carefully than if you are doing, you know, iterations with a fellow colleague or whatnot. So, yeah,
I think they're all over now. Well, I mean, I think it's I mean, for me, the theoretical questions and the larger abstract questions are in many ways more interesting for the purposes of a conversation like this than the more technical and pragmatic ones. But I think that there are so many cognitive biases that we bring to this. I just got back from San Francisco, where, of course, there are all these driverless cars whizzing around. And my initial reaction was that I found it quite creepy to see these cars that have all these, you know, spinning things on top, and there's nobody inside the car. But, you know, I'm also conscious of the fact that if you were to introduce a transportation technology, let's say right now, that enabled me to, you know, teleport overnight to another continent, and that worked, you know, almost all the time, but that every day 10 to 20 people didn't materialize where they were supposed to be. They just vanished. The skepticism that technology would be greeted with would be incommensurate with the fact that 60 to 80 Americans die every day in cars. So there are these things that we, when you know, that are irrational from the standpoint of risk, that are just the nature of us. You know, the nature of how we approach new technologies, that we you know, depending on whether we are in favor or not, we're either technophilic or technophobic. And I think that a lot of the reaction to LLMs right now falls very much into those two camps.
Right. Yeah. And it also makes me think about, well, what is our level of tolerance for error? And is it the same? So it's clearly not the same between, you know, our fellow humans and technology. We have a higher standard for technology. But I think what's interesting to me is thinking about, well, okay, if that's the case, well, maybe we have a different level of tolerance for error if we're talking about, you know, kind of more a social post, you know, that has a comedic element than we do for, I don't know, surgical instructions, right? meaning it's part of the question here is not just, is it accurate, but what are the use cases and what level of tolerance do we have for those? So like you said, with cars, it's like almost zero, right? It's, and we agree, you know, I think there was, I remember seeing a news story about one accident, you know, that in a driverless car, people were like, oh, that's it, we're done, you know, back to humans. And it's like, well, actually the exception to the rule should show us how incredible it has been till now. And I think maybe that's kind of where the questions become, each maybe industry needs to think for themselves about, you know, kind of, well, what is our tolerance for error, A? And then B is, what is our current error rate, right? You know, with human peer review, or with, you know, maybe potentially, you know, obviously we're all trying to, you know, avoid the paper mill problems and things like that. So let's not be naive and assume that like right now everything's 100. And so we expect AI to be 100, but actually be able to compare apples to apples, which is not an easy thing to do because we don't necessarily know our own industry exactly how accurate our content is.
Yeah, I think that's key. I think also what's key is the agency or the origin of the error, right? That's the thing that everybody finds creepy about a lot of LLMs. I have on three consecutive days, a couple of months ago, I asked ChatGPT-4 to write a 200-word biography of me, and it made up a different, demonstrably false fact every time about a degree I had, an institution I attended, an association that I was a member of. And I think that's the thing, you know, it goes back to that Kevin Roos piece in the New York Times about I forget which LLM it was, basically late at night texting back and forth and basically trying to break up his marriage. You know, that the thing is, he can know intellectually that this thing is just responding to two people at a certain time of day, getting to know each other via this medium. And the conclusion that it draws is, you know, I should be trying to insinuate myself sexually into this person's life or romantically. And that's where we're publishing a book in a little while called The AI Mirror. And one of the things that the author highlights, which I think is very interesting, is, you know, we keep talking about human parameters and human ethics as being the litmus test, the bar that we should set. And her argument is we've got to set that bar much higher. I think that's an interesting thought, that we shouldn't be, you know, just using ourselves as the barometer, since we don't really do all that well. But I think that agency of error question, that's a really hard thing to get around, right? And that's where the example of the teleportation machine holds up, because you don't know where those people who disappeared are. If somebody dies in a car crash, you know that. And of course, these aren't questions that are new. We published a whole book called Robot Ethics, which basically takes, you know, all these philosophical conundra, the fat man on the bridge, the trolley problem, and translates them to different forms of technology. You know, if you're driving down the street and you're driving the car and you see a baby carriage suddenly in front of you, like rolling in front of you, you draw as a human being a different conclusion if you see a screaming, frantic parent versus two, you know, teenage boys sort of looking mischievous, right? And you draw a conclusion there that would make you act one way or the other, especially if that action imperils somebody else, because there is an old elderly couple walking on the other side of the street and you have to mow over to avoid that baby carriage, right? Now, when human beings are the agents of those decisions, even if they made the wrong decisions, we are able to process that. But if you don't know what the origin of the decision is, it's unsettling. And I think that that's where we are with a lot of the inaccuracies. And I mean, that Kevin Roos piece was, you know, terrifically entertaining along those lines, because it had the added element of being funny and creepy.
Yeah. And I think the source, obviously that's a big question here. And I think more than, you know, maybe even more than the hallucinations, which I think if we're taught, educated properly, we can understand, you know, let's not take this, everything that we get with a group, you know, take everything that you get with a grain of salt, but understanding kind of, well, okay, what is this? What is the salad? Like, what are the different components that make it up? There was actually a great piece in the Washington Post a few months back where they actually tried to deconstruct GPT and figure out what its sources were. And I remember being surprised at like how big of a mix it really was. And to the point where it's almost like, this is almost not appropriate for any use case. Meaning it's excellent as a general model that it's taking from the entire internet. But most of us in our day-to-day work have actually much more specific, like you said, the SLMs, the small language models, maybe do a better job to
well, it's also, it's What's interesting about that is how, again, I just always think about these subjects in terms of the different levels, where it's like fun to have a cocktail conversation about it in the abstract. And then there's a question about responsibilities that different institutions have. And then there is the self-interest of both the individual and the institution. I think that, I forget now which piece it was. Maybe it was that piece about Wikipedia and ChatGPT or LLMs in the Sunday Times Magazine the other day. But it talked about this site that coders go to when they've written a bit of code that they think could be transferable and useful, and they deposit it there. And ChatGPT scrapes that site. And as a result, people are actually now just asking questions of ChatGPT, but the number of contributions that are now being made to that site are diminishing. So you have a problem where the source site is actually becoming less valuable by virtue of the accretive aggregated value of the LLM. And how you, that's a version of the way in which reference publishers have addressed Wikipedia by vilifying what is one of the most extraordinary things that's happened, I think, in our lifetimes in this, voluntary gratis creation of this magnificent resource. We've tried to think, how can we actually take our vetted content and make that something that is Wikipedia either draws from or links to, right? That is, I think, the obvious approach. But I think that does this pose existential challenges to certain businesses? Yeah, absolutely. I think the flip side of what I was saying about, originality and creativity is digesting and distilling. If your business model is based upon digesting and distilling, I think you really have to have real concerns. And I think there are certain publishers, Oxford included, where there are certain kinds of publishing that we do that are very much along those lines, right? That take a corpus of knowledge and try to refine it and kind of distill it down to being a consumable chunk. And that, I think, is likely to be affected by this technology pretty quickly.
Yeah. Now, I'm curious, I think it's very early days, but I am curious to hear from you about, kind of circling back to my original thesis, which is that, well, what would a world look like whereby we could build LLMs based on, scientific literature? And the more I think about it, the more I realize that even the big AI companies, like, they have a vested interest in getting the best content possible. Even if they're not going to use that for their general models, I'd have to imagine that if they want to kind of, they want people to build off their platforms, which is, I think, what, NVIDIA and OpenAI and Anthropic are, want to happen. The most valuable use cases are going to be the ones that are based off the, actual accurate, and verified information. And even more so, I guess, that there is an argument that's been put forth that, the most valuable information might actually be the information that's private, right? It can't be scraped by these LLMs on their own, but actually, there's agreements that need to be made. I think there was recently an agreement made between OpenAI and AP. And I saw also in the publishing context that Clarivate basically announced an agreement that they're going to be partnering with AI 21 Labs. They were very vague about what exactly they were going to be doing and how that would look. But I'm curious if, from what you're allowed to say and, from your seat, if you've seen any kind of meeting of the minds between maybe some of these LLMs or their, the companies behind them and some of the major academic publishers. And do you think those are going to be meetings that are kind of or conversations that are going to be taking place?
Yeah, I think those conversations absolutely have to take place. And I think they in some cases already are. I think there's also the sensitivity around the framing of those conversations. I think that, so that's a big question. Your point about do we need to rely on this vetted content? I think that is, incontrovertibly, the answer to that is yes. And I'm reminded, years ago, I was at a meeting of a library consortium, SOCHE, I think it's called, in Ohio, of I think about 100 or so small liberal arts colleges in Ohio. And one of the questions that came up, I was one of the few publishers in the room, and it was right during the peak of all the sort of information about author services publishing and the fact that we had gone in the U.S. from a country that was publishing in the neighborhood of 250,000 ISBNs, so sort of separate books a year, to publishing over 3 million in a very short period of time. And the librarians were saying, what do we do with all this? How on earth can we possibly? And my suggestion was, ignore it. ignore it. Most of this is, you know, family memoirs. Most of this is content that is not the kind of content you want to be providing to your academic community. They don't need it. They don't want it. They're, you know, it's fan fiction. It's romance novels. And that's not to in any way disparage that content. It's just not the right content for that community. And I think there is what, you know, it's a garbage in, garbage out point, right? It seems to me entirely self-evident that if you are trying to index something and you have a lot of misinformation or corrupt data, that what comes out of it is going to be wrong. So I think this refining process, I think we're going to be in that stage now going forward. And is that going to be a turf battle? It seems to me almost unavoidably so. Yeah. And in terms of, I mean, obviously I'm not free to speak about Oxford's position in all this, but I think you have people, whether they are entities, whether they are, you know, publishers, commercial organizations, or individuals who have good, viable content that is their intellectual property. And this is where I think that not-for-profit university press type organizations have a really important role to play, because I think the suspicion that is cast by many at for-profit entities as wanting to colonize every new technology, that's not entirely unfounded. I mean, that is really, if you look at, for instance, the history of open access in certain ways, capitalist forces, you know, they do what capitalist forces do, is they look for market opportunities and look for ways in which to position their organizations in that universe in a way that is advantageous to them. And so I think that that's very much where we are right now. And I think it's going to be absolutely fascinating to see how this plays out over the course of the next few years, because it's so much about this is indeterminate. You know, the argument about whether something, you know, the term transformative use, I think is going to be one that we're all going to become very familiar with if we aren't already, when it comes to what scraping a site actually is and does and means. So, I'll leave it at that.
I think I've learned a lot more about copyright law over the last few weeks in investigating this topic than I ever thought I would. But it's quite fascinating, because a lot of this basically comes down to the question of, you know, what as a society, what are, or, you know, kind of as legal precedent, you know, what is the meaning of taking content? You know, I think we're all kind of clear on the what I like to call the Drake case, which is kind of, you know, you take Drake's music, you mix it up, and then you create a new Drake song, right? That's kind of like, I think everyone has this sort of intuitive feeling of like, no, we're like Drake should be upset about that. Whereas I think when it's a lot more generic in general and you can't trace back, and I think that's very intentional, by the way, that OpenAI doesn't provide the source of their information, but we can't trace it back. It's almost kind of like, well, go prove that this was, you know, that you had one infinitesimal, percentage point in this and what the value, and, you know, go try and put a number on that. That's where I think, it's really interesting. And I also think, like, it makes me wonder also, even if that could be done, well, then, you know, authors, obviously, you know, depending on the exact kind of agreement they come to with the publisher, they're signing over their license in return for the services rendered by the publisher. But it also makes me wonder whether authors are going to try to, you know, rethink their ownership over their content, if it's going to be then repurposed for AI, you know, as well. And you know, I think I've definitely seen, for those who aren't familiar, you know, I've seen a trend of kind of authors asking themselves hard questions about where they want to publish and how they want to publish. And I think publishers themselves understanding that, you know, authors need to be involved in this conversation. So yeah, I think as you said, the more we dive in, it the more kind of complicated and complex it gets.
I think you touched on a really good point, though, and a really important point, which is around this question of aggregated content, right? Is whether individual authors will be able to negotiate this for themselves. And in my experience over, you know, 3.5 decades, most authors, take open access, for instance. I spent much of the last 5 years trying to think of ways in which to explain open access in a neither jingoistic nor pejorative way to academics, and to do it in a way that actually they can understand. I mean, that sounds patronizing, not to understand, but the way they can apply it to how they're writing their works. And it's reminded me all the way back to the days of early days of print on demand, where we had this new technology that was genuinely transformative for us as publishers, because we weren't held captive by the economies of scale, and we could simply print a book, one at a time. And I remember trying to figure out a good metaphor to explain this, and it took me a while to land on one, until finally it was about wine and the bottling mechanism for wine, which is basically how you print a book. Nobody cares how you print a book, right? What they care is that what it looks like when they hold it in their hand. And I think that, trying to unpack this one, as you were talking, I was reminded of a phenomenon we experience as academic publishers not infrequently, where we publish a quite academic book, and then a journalist writes a book on a very similar topic, but writes it in a very journalistic way. And again, I'm not being pejorative here, I'm just being entirely factual, and does what's known as sourcing through our book, basically cites the primary sources that our author did. And the author is infuriated because the author feels like they're the one who is in the archives, they're the one who's done all this, and the sources match very closely their own. But they're accurate, and you don't have ownership to archives, and you don't need to be doing that research yourself. And there is no theft of intellectual property. There might be an ethical question. But so to go to your point about how do you attribute any of this when you can't even figure out why things are being answered the way they are, and much less attach a compensation model to it, I think that's very, very challenging. But at the same time, I think a fragmentation of this valuable content will probably not do anybody any good. You want to ideally consolidate that as much as possible. And, for entirely understandable self-interested reasons, I'm in favor of that consolidation happening at not-for-profit university presses, because that's the world I happen to occupy.
Yeah. Without getting into too much of a deep dive, I'm going to recommend, and they're non-sponsor, so there's no bias here, but there's a podcast called More Perfect, and it's about the U.S. Supreme Court, and I recently listened to an episode about Andy Warhol, and basically he took a photo of a prince, which was copyright, and he then painted it, and kind of added some unique elements, and the original photographer sued him for copyright violation. And he, and you mentioned this point about transformative use. And then, the question becomes, well, is what he did transformative or not? And I think that's kind of an open-ended question. And even the concept of transformative to begin with is like a very, they actually interview an academic who came up with this term. He's like, yeah, I just meant this to be kind of like a first stab in the dark about trying to come up with a way of defining fair use. And really it didn't evolve, or it's not clear enough what this means. So it's a really interesting episode. And I think it's a good kind of framing for thinking about this, this topic.
Yeah. Well, do you remember the whole controversy about whether or not you could trademark the color of the bottom of a shoe? It was about Louboutins, the designer shoe, and the bottom is always red. And there was a court case about this. And we published a book which was about the different ways in which different industries deal with imitation. So you look at, for instance, the restaurant industry, and imitation runs rampant, right? You look at, we were talking earlier about like stand-up comedy before we got on, and that's the most egregious offense you can possibly commit in the world of stand-up comedy is stealing somebody else's joke, right? But if some chef does your miso-covered black cod, everybody does your miso-covered black cod. That's just an assumed act. So this varies so different, so much from industry to industry. And each usage case, I think, is, even if they're quite similar, they're different in certain ways. So this is why intellectual property is such a febrile area.
Yeah, I guess imitation is the best form of flattery is lovely to know, but it's not always nice when you're the author. I've got a lot more questions, but I'm cognizant of time, so let's just finish off with one, I guess more pragmatic and practical question, which is that if you were to be kind of in a chat with a publisher, with other publishers, and they would ask you kind of, what can we do to because it's such a big topic and because it's changing so quickly, either prepare ourselves or to kind of, see what it is that, you know, how to prepare themselves as an institution for AI. What are kind of like, you know, a few of the points that you would say to that?
Well, I think thinking about the ways in which this can be beneficially used, I think is the crucial thing. And I think that what we still aren't entirely clear on is whether if a piece of content is ingested by an LLM, what exactly does that mean in every sense of the word? I would be very surprised if we didn't already have, as I said earlier, authors who aren't thinking about these issues because, again, they're thinking about their book, they're thinking about their subject. They don't think about these issues, nor should they necessarily. But who are already doing things that where they're just loading their manuscripts into, take it for instance, keywords and abstracts. I don't think anybody or indexes. Nobody thinks to themselves, I can't wait to do the keywords and abstracts or the index for my books. That's, you know, so if there's a way in which to do that in a shorthand way, I think the primary fork in the road here, and I made this mistake earlier in response to one of your questions, is to immediately go to content creation, right? Everybody does, because that's sexy and that's interesting. And the fact is, I think there are an enormous number of ways in which technology like this can be brought to fruitful use, whether it's, we talked about translation, but the whole variety of sort of non-content creation related tasks, I think is, there are any number of them. You could, and again, that point about not is it perfect, but is it better and faster than the alternatives you've been relying on all along. So, you know, marketing copy, customer service chatbots, proofreading, certainly, my God, proofreading, the kind of metadata creation around keywords and abstracts, also usage and sales analysis. I think you could save yourself a lot of time and effort there. Plagiarism detection would be another one. So I think there are a lot of things that we can do. I think there is anxiety around it because it's such a massive subject and everybody is still really trying to get their brain around the parameters of it. I think there's a ton to do. I'm reminded of, remember when David Byrne started playing around with PowerPoint and created this art display basically based on PowerPoint, and it of course bore no resemblance to PowerPoint, but it was, one of the more interesting PowerPoint presentations that I've ever seen. I think there are stages to this, right? Right now we're in the mistrust, what is the integrity of the information stage. Look at Wikipedia. We were having very similar conversations when Wikipedia first came about. And Wikipedia is now pretty established, right? It's not as controversial as it was. It's not this, this thing that we endlessly debate. We understand it. We understand what its limitations are. We understand what its massive benefits are. And I think that will... It's not a perfect example though, because Wikipedia is actually very easy to understand. This goes off in so many different directions that and nobody really. I would say it's one of these subjects that the only positions I tend to really mistrust are the ones where people absolutely have staked out a position they know they're right, because I think it's impossible to be that prescient this early on.
Yeah, for sure. I'll just end off by saying that if anyone's kind of curious to learn more and, kind of about AI specifically in a research context, first of all, I would highly recommend following Professor Ethan Mollick from Penn. He's got some really excellent materials online about how he's approaching teaching this coming semester with AI, how he's approaching research writing and literature reviews. And then in addition, for anyone who's interested, I'm actually currently running a course in the middle of the course called AI Tool Up Tuesdays, which is actually featuring over 20 of AI tools that are specific for research. And the reason that I'm excited about these tools is because they actually have taken into account a lot of the problematics that come along with the generative models. They actually are resolved in some of these AI-specific or research-specific tools that are built. And the founders and the entrepreneurs are generally researchers themselves who have kind of come to solve a really difficult issue. So, whether it's, supercharging your literature review, or it's, help with research writing. These are really, really cool people and then cool tools that they're building out. So I'll drop that in the show notes for anyone who's interested. Nico, I don't know if you're active on any kind of, social platforms, if you have any, writing anywhere, if anyone does want to kind of follow up, read more either about Oxford or yourself, what's the best way to do that?
You know what? Just email me. By virtue of my position, I tend to keep a fairly low profile on social media. So nico.fund@oup.com. And I'm always happy to hear from folks. So please don't hesitate.
Fantastic. Thanks so much for taking the time today. I know I learned a lot. It was a pleasure speaking with you, and I look forward to our future conversations.
Yeah, likewise. Thanks so much, Albie.